This is an ABC podcast.
Something we love to do each year on Conversations is to hold live events at writers' festivals around the country. For these, hundreds of you will make your way down to the tent or to the hall or the amphitheatre to be part of the show. When we listen back to the recordings of these events, they're made all the richer by the huge waves of applause and the weird laughter, the very presence and attention of the crowd. We've had some unforgettable guests over the years brought out by the festivals, so this week, given that most of our writers' festivals for 2020 have had to be cancelled, we're going to recreate the huge pleasure of getting together to share stories with a week of great episodes from the festivals. First up, James Rebanks. In the northwest corner of England, there's an area that's known as the Lake District. It's famously beautiful. The epic landscape was immortalised by the poet Wordsworth. James Rebanks' family has been keeping sheep on a small property here for more than 600 years. James is not your typical shepherd, if there is such a thing. He grew up on the land, loving it deeply. He hated school and he dropped out at 15. But he returned to education and was admitted to Oxford University. The whole time he was there, though, James couldn't wait to get back to the farm, the sheep and the land. While shepherding, James started posting tweets of his life on the fells of Cumbria, and he became an unlikely social media phenomenon, and he was asked to write a book about his life. So he wrote a best-selling book called The Shepherd's Life, which he followed with the illustrated Herdwick Shepherd. James Rebanks was invited to Australia as a guest of the Sydney Writers' Festival, and I spoke with James on stage at the Ros Packer Theatre at the Rocks, and his wife and three kids were in the audience too. Can you describe the landscape of the area you live in, around Matterdale?
The Lake District, for those of you that don't know, is 800 square miles of, they used to think, the worst bits of England. So when they did the Doomsday Book, they didn't even have it in the Doomsday Book because it was considered to be too poor, barbaric, and the people that lived there were considered to be too ignorant and unworthy of being taxed. But unfortunately, they've come for us since then for the tax. But it's the rugged bit in the top left-hand corner at the northwest of England. As many of you will know, it doesn't have the world's biggest mountains or the world's biggest lakes. But for about 250 years, almost everybody that could pick up a pen thought it was the most beautiful place in English literature. And it's one of the most written about places on earth. So when I step out of my house, I'm looking across onto a fell. Fell's our dialect word for a mountain, called Gowborough Fell, and just over the top of Gowborough Fell was where Wordsworth wrote his Daffodils, I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud. And literally, you can't walk down the road where I live without stumbling into a writer or a poet or an artist. It's one of the most artistic landscapes on earth, but that's for a reason. It's very beautiful.
How long has your family been connected to this part of the world, James?
I keep being quoted in the press as we've been there for 600 years. That's not strictly true. We traced our family tree back, and it went back 600 years before the church records ceased to exist. So we're still there 600 years ago, which I assume means we might have been there another 600 years before that, or who knows how long. And that's true of a lot of those families. It's a very, very settled, stuck way of life. When I was growing up, I thought, what's wrong with us? Why don't we go anywhere? And then a little later I thought, no, actually, this displays great common sense. If you live somewhere beautiful, why would you go somewhere else?
We're looking at Herdwick sheep. They're the sheep you look after. Yeah. What are the special characteristics of these sheep?
They're the toughest sheep. They're probably one of the toughest breeds of sheep in the world. They're tough for surviving on cold, wet mountains, which is what the Lake District is. So we get sometimes seven or eight months of wet, sleety, snowy, rubbish weather. I just learned recently that the Russians like it when it gets to minus 20, minus 30, because it's dry. Yeah, it's dry cold. But when it's minus one and it's raining and you feel damp in your bones, they call that English weather. Well, the Lake District has the worst English weather of absolutely anywhere.
You write in your book that the sheep are so tough they can smell weakness. When I read that, I thought, wow. And then I thought, hang on, we're talking about sheep here, aren't we? What do you mean they can smell weakness?
It wasn't psychological weakness I was talking about, really. It was what I was talking about was when we gather the fells, you're entirely dependent on having good sheepdogs. Okay, so if I take all of you onto the fells where my sheep are, where the 10 flocks are, you could all run around like silly buggers for all day and all tomorrow, and we wouldn't come down with the sheep. They understand the gaps between you. They understand how fast you are. They understand the terrain. They beat you. So if you have a dog or you have shepherds that don't know what they're doing, they can perhaps not smell it out. That maybe wasn't the right word, but they can sense it. So it's all about having people, whether they're men or women. It doesn't matter. There's loads of fantastic female shepherds where I live. But you need great dogs who are smart enough to adapt to what's going on. Quite often the dogs are working in rocky crags on the mountains out of sight, and the sheep's frankly taking the piss trying to go down a crag or do something, and you can't see. And you need a really smart dog that can go and work that out for itself and fetch them back.
You write about the sheep being hefted. What does that mean, hefted?
Hefted is a dialect word, and it basically means the sheep have this really powerful sense of belonging to a particular place on the mountain.
So a particular place?
Particular place. It's the largest area of common land in Europe, I think I'm told, Western Europe anyway. There are no fences, basically. These flocks of sheep are taken up to places on the mountain and unsupervised stay 95% of the time in the area that they're supposed to be in, the sort of traditional grazing area of the fell, the heft.
How do they know that? Is there some kind of, I don't know, what do they do? They urinate and mark territory or
no,
what? How do they
no,
do that?
No, it's because sheep are smarter than you think they are. They, for every spring and every summer for the best part of 5,000 years, the mother has taken the lamb back, like I took mine back last week, and has taught that lamb, this is where we live. This is the best place on earth. We don't stray from here. We go a little bit apart, but we go back to this place. And
just like you.
Yeah, just like me.
Seriously, yeah.
Although they don't have trips to Australia and, yeah.
Not yet, anyway. You mentioned their sheepdogs. What kind of sheepdog do you need to be a shepherd in the fells?
Well, a bloody good one, to be honest. I don't know if you've ever watched the BBC programme One Man and His Dog.
I certainly
quite
have.
Eccentric bit of England. But
yeah, this is like a top rating show in Britain. Top rating show on British television of shepherds rounding up sheep.
Yeah.
This is primetime TV and it is strangely compelling.
Okay, so for those of you that haven't watched that, you can get these very, very fancy dogs, which in a flat field for TV, you can do a beautiful job of rounding them up. They're sort of show ponies, really. We don't like those. You need a much smarter, tougher, street-smart dog for the fells. We're less interested in whether they look beautiful and they're sort of technically perfect. You need a smart, tough dog that can work for hours and hours and hours, sometimes in the heat of the day, sometimes in the snow, sometimes unsupervised, 15 minutes after you told it to do something, the other side of a mountain ridge or something. So,
but you can tell a sheepdog to do something and leave it alone for 15 minutes and it will complete that task you've given it?
I wish I had a picture of this, but I have a friend called Joe Weir who has some of the best sheepdogs where I live, and he can send his dog the best part of 2 miles onto a mountain that you're looking onto, down into the valley bottom, right up to the other side, and he can make it bring back 50, 100 sheep. We're even standing there with our mouths open thinking, I don't even know how that dog can hear you, let alone do that.
What kind of sheepdogs have you got?
I have border collies, so my friend Joe says they're field dogs. He says they're not fell dogs. But and the distinction there is there are two kinds of sheepdogs. There are dogs that control sheep by their eyes. Just like I'm doing with you now, Richard.
Yeah, I know.
Just like no more silly questions, right. Just good questions. So that's how they do it. And then there's a sort of more mongrelly type dog, which is a fell dog, which is, it doesn't even look at the sheep. It's more, for example, if you have a mountainside and it has like 300 acres of bracken and there are 50 sheep hidden in the bracken, these fell dogs will almost sort of hunt the sheep out. They don't touch the sheep, but they'll very clever. They know their job is to sniff through these bracken and fetch the sheep out. And that's nothing about the eyes. See the eyes? I've got you.
Yeah, you do. It's a whole Manchurian candidate thing going on here at the moment. I'm going to work for him without pay as a shepherd for the next 10 years of my life. I know this is what's going on. I should warn
you
about
this. I'm going to have you running around a
mountain. Yeah, that's right. Come round. How much work went into that land in your valley to make it farmable back in the 12th and 13th? It would have been a forest once, wouldn't it?
It was a forest for a while after the ice cleared 10,000 years ago. It's sort of been man-made in one shape or another ever since the ice retreated, but it becomes much more intense in the last 5,000 years when they turn up with sheep and they turn up with cattle, and particularly in the last 1,000 years when its really distinctive look of the small fields with the dry stone walls and the hedges has emerged. So it's literally 10,000 years worth of effort went into it, and it's remarkable. I mean, if you look at sort of satellite imagery of the dry stone walls in the Lake District, it's like one of the wonders of the world. It's sensational, and nobody in their right mind would do it if you were starting out now. It wouldn't make sense, but But I personally love the fact that those people did that, and they're just so much a symptom of the place. It gets really interesting and challenging when you realise that we're not the most efficient sheep farmers on earth. So do we knock all of the walls down and ranch that landscape and make it much more sort of modern and intensive agriculture? Or can you find a way to keep those things alive? And do we want to keep them alive? So it raises a whole bunch of questions.
And, of course, your answer to that would be yes, of course. But I'm sure there are plenty of people from your equivalent of the Productivity Commission showing up going, knock it down, turn it into one great big thing.
I've heard all week about the Productivity Commission. They sound like proper idiots about books.
Who actually owns your farm?
The land in the bottom where my farmhouse is situated and my fields where I met my hay is ours. So it's tiny by Australian standards. It's 185 acres that we own, and then we have another 100 acres that we rent off a neighbouring farmer. And then I have the rights to take my sheep in the summer to the mountains, but the mountains don't belong to us. And the mountains are crazy in England. Everything's so messy and fantastically messy there. So historically, the mountains belong to the Lord of the Manor, but the Lord of the Manor didn't want to do anything with them. They were what they call manorial waste. So they did a
manorial
deal.
Waste.
Manorial waste. That's the technical term. And the deal was simple. The Lord of the Manor said, "Hey, you scumbags and peasants, you can put your sheep on the mountain, but every 5 or 10 years when we go to fight the Scots, your rent is you've got to pick up a pitchfork and you've got to come and fight the Scots." And if you've looked at the battles between the English and the Scots, there's a lot of running away going on. So I'm not sure how committed we were to that rivalry.
But of course, if they leave the Union, you may be asked to do that yourself one day, pick up a pitchfork and invade Glasgow. That could happen.
And the really interesting bit of that is in around about 1750, there's this thing called the Staveley Revolt, where the Lords of the Manor said, "Okay, it's time to fight the Scots." And we went, "Woo!" And we took our pitchforks and we turned up at the place where you're supposed to gather and said, "Actually, we don't think we'll fight the Scots. How about we have a go at you instead?" And and they said, "Actually, it's okay. You can go back and you can continue to graze the mountains. And you don't have to fight the Scots anymore." So for the last 250, 300 years, we've had an enshrined legal right. It's a sense of legal ownership to take a certain number of sheep to the mountains on their mountain. And the best bit is they can't even graze their own mountain. How cool is that? They don't have legal rights to graze because they never did. So the peasants won. We won. And I think that's fantastic.
You're hearing my conversation with James Rebanks, the Herdwick Shepherd from the Fells of Cumbria in the northwest of England. I spoke with him at a live event at the Sydney Writers' Festival. You know, I recently was in Iceland, and there's the thing about, you know, Iceland is a bit like, we're overlooked, but they also know there are huge benefits sometimes in being overlooked. Yeah. Do you think your part of the world is like that too?
Yeah, I do, and it's not a very original thought. We had as everybody knows, we had a poet called William Wordsworth, and when he came back from the French Revolution, he came back to our area where he was from. He was a sort of local land agent's son, and he thought the same thing. He said, "Hang on a minute, the people I hate that they've just been chopping their heads off in France aren't in charge here. They're only notionally in charge. The people who regulate themselves, this is quite egalitarian. People have much more control over the way that they live and the way that they earn their living." So he thought it was a political landscape with a small p that the rest of the world could learn from.
I mean, the class system is just not as present in that part of the world.
In my view, not very much of that. I was quite surprised when I got sort of 15, 20 years old, whatever it was, and travelled to the south of England to discover how class-ridden the rest of England was. It just isn't like that. It was a landscape that was forgotten and was so poor that stuff didn't establish itself. So there were farmers that were more wealthy than other farmers and craftsmen and others, but nobody was rich enough to get snooty. You sat down at the same table, you ate together, and the culture where I live and the way of life is the same. If I go home and start lording it over people because I've been to Australia and written a book, they'll kick my ass.
How do you get honour in a village like where you live?
Well, usually by killing radio presenters. I'm being
four
really
or five
silly.
Now.
Really silly. I've caught this off him. I'm not this silly. The respect where I live and in my way of life is basically about the quality of your work. So genuinely, my friends and family and the people that do what I do are very nice about the fact I wrote a book, but my shepherding street cred is based on the fact that I have a good flock of sheep, sometimes a very good flock of sheep, and I'm able to win some of the sheep shows that we have and the competitions where we're competing with each other. And If I let that slip because I'm in Australia talking to you, they'll just absolutely mercilessly rip the hell out of me. So it's all about being good at what you do. And they literally don't care if you're old, young, man, woman. It's all about the sheep.
Australians are famously good at creative swearing. How about Cumbria? What are they like where you live?
I think we can give you a run for your money.
What kind of creative swearing? I'm going to block your ears if you're sensitive to this kind of thing.
Well, I had a friend of mine say something fantastic the other day. He'd had a meeting with a tax inspector who'd come out, and he said, "I've never met such a self-wanking bastard in all my life." Is that going to make it onto the radio?
Self-wanking bastard is just such a great phrase. Can you translate this phrase into local dialect for me, please? How would you translate, "This chap seems a little work shy. I don't care for him very much"?
This geezer's a sooner, and he's sooner's the key word.
What does sooner mean?
Sooner means you'd sort of sooner sit in and watch the Oprah Winfrey Show than go out and work.
The Oprah Winfrey Show has been broadcasting Cumbria for 600 years now. It's been around that long.
We're totally authentic. There's nothing changed there.
What constitutes a foreigner in your part of the world?
Sort of anyone outside of the valley.
Like an Italian or someone in Scotland?
Oh, no, that's like almost an alien.
Right.
My grandfather would call somebody a foreigner that was from just beyond the sort of valley or the bounds of our universe.
Seriously, call them a foreigner?
Yeah, call them a foreigner.
With a shake of the head?
It's,
right.
It wasn't a sort of hugely sort of racist xenophobic thing. It was more making the point that they won't understand because they're not from our... They don't do the things we do. They're the people 10 miles away outside the valley that farm differently, think differently. It wasn't a sort of bigotry thing. It was more... alter what we're doing or what we're saying because that person won't understand.
Tell me a bit about your grandfather. He might be the most important man in your life in many ways. Paint me a picture as you remember him as a boy.
He was my hero when I was a boy. So our farm revolved around him. He was a sort of patriarch. It's only much later I realised that my dad was the butt of that. You know, that's how families work, isn't it? Everybody can't be the boss. And sadly, my dad was the one that took the brunt of my granddad being the big guy at that time. But
what did he look like?
He was a sort of quite sturdy sort of Cumbrian farmer. By the time I knew him, he was sort of quite stubbly. He had one sort of tooth.
One?
One tooth. His favourite thing was like chewing the meat off a lamb chop. And he was like a jackal. He could get all the meat off with one tooth. But I'm sort of joking about his appearance, but he was like astonishingly smart about things as well and had done sort of amazing things in his own world. So he trained out of a little farmyard, he trained racehorses and was very good at it. And I remember being really surprised. He took me once to a little sort of farmer's northern racing track in England. And one minute he's talking to this guy that like catches the crows or whatever on our farm, like a really working class guy, and they were friends and completely equal. And the next minute he's chatting to the Queen Mother's racehorse trainer, and he was calling him by his first name because they were all friends. It was just like he knew everybody, but it was always with that sort of egalitarian, almost Australian attitude that I'm as good as you and you're as good as me. And when I was a kid, I read The Old Man and the Sea by Ernest Hemingway. And I loved the relationship between the boy and the old man. And I thought, oh, the boy's me and the old fisherman is my grandfather. Somebody should write a book about, like, the boy that's me and the grandfather who's my grandfather. And it was only later when I was actually writing my book that I realised actually my dad is every bit as good as my grandfather. And it was my dad that was my hero, really. So the book became like a letter to my dad. And he read it through before he died. And all this nice stuff that's happening to me because of the book, it doesn't really mean anything compared to the fact that my dad read the book, so, yeah.
It seems like your grandfather, in his own way, was very tender with you. How would he talk to you when you were out as a little boy
He always used to say, "Us two men will go and do such and such. Us two old men will go and gather the sheep. Us two men will go and sort things out."
Us two old men?
I don't know why he said that. I was absolutely baffled. And he used to call me squire. You know, like the knights in days of old used to have a squire that carried their armour. I was his squire, apparently.
Us two old men, that's like saying you're just like me, isn't it?
I think so. And it was, there was very much a, I mean, we had a probably a ridiculously romantic view of ourselves, but I felt like I was important. I felt like he was training me to do what he did. And because I thought him and our farm were the most important things in the world when I was 15, and still do in many ways, I was getting my education. It was like, you may have been at school all week, but it's Saturday morning now, and this is the important stuff, and I'm going to teach you, and I'm going to teach you how to do it properly. He didn't say any of this. It was just implicit in what he was doing. And I'm going to try and pass on the values to you, because you'll have to keep this alive, and you have to do this. And I loved that. I understood that implicitly, what he was doing. And I was sort of quite honoured to be treated as somebody so important when I'm like a little eight-year-old following him around. I tried to do that with my own children. So I have three children here today, and they've just helped me all through lambing times, particularly my two daughters, who are 10 and 8, but my son Isaac as well, who's 4, have all been lambing sheep, and they get stuck in, and they learn about it. And
at that age? Right.
Yeah, yeah, no problem. You can lamb a sheep, can't you, Isaac? You'd think we practiced that, but we really didn't.
That is the most eye-wateringly cute moment on my whole radio career, I think. That was amazing. I know you're quite a few k's north of where Wuthering Heights was set, but yeah. The thing about reading Wuthering Heights that really stays with me after having read it is how much those two properties are the whole world for all those characters. There's a moment where, goes off to Liverpool and comes back to find Heathcliff and all that, but that's just like so far away. It's the whole world is on those two farms. Yep. Was it like that for you too?
Yes, a little bit broader in that, and I still think all the people I'm from think like that, that your world is your farm. It doesn't exactly end at the edge of the farm, because you sell sheep to other people on other farms, and you go to the same auction marts, and you take part in the same kind of events. So it sort of stretches out to the boundaries of the other people doing what you do. And that's sort of the edge of the known universe. So there's a mountain to the south of where we live called Shap Fell. It's not the most beautiful mountain, but I was brought up to believe that was the southern boundary of civilization. And everything south of there, London, everything, no, they're the Badlands.
I suppose it's one of those places where you can stand on a fell or a mountain and look, and it looks like there's the whole of God's creation in front of you. Yeah. There's a kind of a cosmos in that.
Yeah, and I think mountains do that as well. Mountains make for a particular kind of people. So one of my intellectual heroes is a French historian called Fernand Braudel, and he said that. He said, when you look around the Mediterranean and places and the Caucasus and the Carpathians, you end up with very stubborn, fierce people with particular kinds of values. Environments shape people, and I think mountains make for particularly stubborn and resistant people.
So it's all very well going lambing at the age of one, whatever it was you started lambing, but you had to go to school at some point. Why did you? Tell me about the dread you felt about going to school.
I never ever wanted to go to school, which is pretty horrible for my mum, because my mum wasn't from the same background as us. She was a teacher's daughter that had gone crazy at a dance and met my dad and decided it was a good idea to marry him. By the way, I'll just tell you a strange family story. My mum told me recently after my dad died, I said, how did you meet dad? And she said, we went to a dance, and I went with another guy, and the guy fell down the stairs, he was so drunk. And she said, your dad was really quick and really classy. He stepped in and he asked me to dance, and that was it. And which made me wonder about my mum, but anyway, But the two details I love, this is my dad when he's 19, who I've always thought is a really, never told a lie in his life. Apparently he told my mum that his name was John Williams, which it was not, and that he had a really flash motorbike outside, as if she wasn't going to find out. But they were married for 42 years, and thank God for that.
But school was horrible. School was something you dreaded.
I didn't want to go to school at all. I absolutely hated school. I can remember trying to hide behind the village hall in the village where we lived, so... And I thought I could get away with it. Like, you know, the school bus would go, and then I'd go back in the house and say, Mom, I'm really sorry, but the bus didn't come today. And,
so when you're educated, though, in school like that, coming from that area, what's the view of how you are to be educated? Is it so you can be literate and numerate and then go back to the farm, or to go and aspire to, I don't know, work in a travel agent or something like that?
My view of it, which might not be from all angles, but my view of it is that from about 1870, when they started to educate people in rural areas and the state paid for it, through till very recently, it was about lifting you out of sort of rural poverty and ignorance. It was a sort of almost sort of colonial type thing, in that they were going to send these smart teachers from the towns to the villages, and they were going to make you brighter and open up your eyes, teach you about civilization. And ideally, you'd get the bug for that, and then you'd go to a city and you'd be an engineer or a teacher or a doctor, whatever it would be. I don't think it ever entered some of those people's minds that the people that they were going to visit have their own self-identity, which isn't about escaping. It wasn't about going elsewhere. So,
and a whole other deep reservoir of knowledge.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just not written down.
And a pride in it. So I was absolutely baffled to discover, not so much in primary school, but certainly by the time I got to secondary school, that some of the teachers thought wanting to do what my dad and granddad did was a sort of deadbeat option. And I remember thinking, what are you talking about? My grandfather's like this really respected person that everybody likes, who lives a great life and who I admire. And now I think I'd have handled it differently, but as a teenager, I just kicked back against that. I thought, if the only point of schooling is to make me go and do something I don't want to do, you can keep schooling. So I did not so hilarious things like when I was 15 in my exams, because I was always quite good at school stuff. I could do it if I want to. I thought it would be hilarious to put the most brilliant answer I possibly could, but to the wrong questions on the exam form. There wasn't much else to do at school apart from flirt with Michelle Brunskill and throw things at the teacher when they weren't looking. Michelle
never got over you, by the way.
Do you want to know something funny? I never saw Michelle Brunskill, who, by the way, I wanted to sit next to at school, and I chose my exam subject so I could sit next to her. And then, hilariously, about 6 months ago, my wife applied for somebody to help us with the farm paperwork, and Michelle Brunskill now works for us one day a month. And she's lovely, but there's no chemistry there at all.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Podcast, broadcast, and online.
So how old were you when you just left school?
Yeah, I got to 15 and everybody knew what I was meant to do. It was to go back and work on the farm. And my mum was quite upset because she knew that I could have done stuff at school and I probably should have done. And then just to go and be contradictory and stubborn, because that's what we do, the minute I left school, I realised about two nights a week I could go out and you could party and you could do stuff like that in the local town. That left five nights a week when there's nothing to do. And I live in the middle of nowhere and I'm at that age where I don't really want to be sitting with my mum and dad in the living room watching what were they? They were not watching TV. So I gravitated towards a bookcase that my mum had and it had all of her father's books in. I didn't know at the time that they were the best books ever written, but he had amazing taste in books. So it's Hemingway, Salinger, Camus, Sartre, and I just started, I didn't even know who these people were, never heard of them. And I started reading through these books and became an incredibly bookish person who just dropped out of school, which is weird.
I've met shearers in Western Queensland and who have these amazing bookshelves because there's no Wi-Fi to speak of. Yeah. TV didn't really reach them then anyway, but it probably does now. But as a result, they have these extraordinary bookshelves full of literature and history. Yeah. So you have these incredibly literary discussions in an outback pub with blokes in blue singlets.
It's actually quite common. As I've got older and I've had a slightly different life where I've met more people, in the Scottish Highlands, they all have the little croft farms. They're some of the most intellectual people you've ever met in your life. They're writing like bloody treatises on Latin subjects and stuff. And they're talking to the farmer and he's pulling out Dylan Thomas's poetry and wants to talk to you about that. People are way smarter than we think of in the hierarchy, aren't we? We think people that go to university and have white-collar jobs and they're the smart ones and everybody else is a bit dumb. No, that's not true. The world, everyone's smart in their own way. We're all doing stuff.
Meanwhile, as all this was happening, your granddad was getting older and your grandmother was worried he just dropped dead in a field one day and no one would find it, but that's not quite what happened. How did your poor old granddad decline?
My granddad had a stroke and died exactly how he didn't want to die, which was sort of tamed and trapped in a room and stuck in a hospital. But he would just look at me the whole time and like shake his head. I think he was trying to tell me that he was going to die and they sent me to get like a sheepdog. All he really wanted to know was about his farm and...
Could he talk a lot?
Why am I crying so much in this interview?
Could he talk at all?
The only word he could say was the name of his farm, which he just said over and over and over again for like a couple of weeks until he died. And he was just worried about stuff about his farm. But we took his sheepdog in and he sort of cried about that as well. I think you can tell whether people have lived the life they wanted to live or by whether they have any regrets. So when my dad found out he was going to die, my mum said, what are the things we need to do that we've never done? And my dad said, I want to go back to the farm. There's a lot of jobs that James can't do I need to do. So all around my farm, there are these lovely new gates that my dad thought I couldn't hang as well as him. And my dad's parting gift was to go around the farm and do all the stuff he thought I was useless at. But that tells you something, doesn't it? My dad didn't have any regrets. Same as me. He lived where he wanted to, did what he wanted to do. And I felt like I haven't read about that kind of person in a book very often. I think there probably are books like that, but I just wanted to write about that as respectfully as I could and try and explain that so other people understand it.
After your grandfather died, what then happened to the property? How did that work?
It was in threat of being broken up. There's a classic thing happens on farms, particularly in beautiful places and national parks like where we live, which is that the actual value of the property far exceeds the agricultural value of it. People would just buy it to live in it and have a beautiful house. So my dad, who'd spent his whole life working for the farm, didn't really have any capital. So suddenly he's having to pay the other members of the family out, his brothers and sisters, and it got a little bit of a mess, and we nearly lost the farm. And we lost the house. We had to sell to sort that out. We had to sell the house that my grandfather lived in. And
for all those years of labour, all he inherited was debt, more or less.
Well, you get to, and to be fair, he kept the farm going, so he got through all of that. But yeah, that's how it works. I mean, it's not the easiest thing. I mean, if you work on a farm, family farm particularly, you quite often get paid peanuts. So yeah, I got paid peanuts for the 9 years after I left school, a tiny amount of money. And the idea is that you're sort of earning your right to take on the business, which technically is worth quite a lot of money sometimes. It can get really messy. And
is this why grandfather to grandson relations are often a lot better than father-son relations?
I think that's what happened in our case, yeah. There's no competition between me and my grandfather. Whereas between father and son there is, isn't there? Sometimes there's a sort of tension about when to hand over and how to hand over, and there's a lot of people nodding, so everybody's got a family. and those things are difficult. There's nothing uniquely difficult about it. It was the story of my family is really the story of lots of people's family, trying to navigate through those things. But I think what changes through my grandfather and then my father and then my life is how fragile the farms get, how little money they're making, and how much the world around it's changing, and how much more money you need to earn to buy a house. So I ended up having a slightly different life for a few years alongside the farm, just doing the money to not get in that hole myself, to be in a position where my wife and I could build a farmhouse to replace the one that my grandfather lost. And
your relationship with your dad broke down for a while.
Yeah.
You weren't talking at all for a while?
We were talking, but it was mostly very loud. and with a lot of F-bombs in there. And I'd just seen what had happened to my dad by loyally working for a father for too long, and my response to that was to kick back against it and go, well, I'm not doing that for you. I want to take over sooner, which is a pretty horrible thing for a 20-year-old to do to his dad in this situation, but hey, 20-year-olds are horrible, aren't they?
It sounds like, you know, for all the wide open spaces there in that part of the world, things can be pretty claustrophobic as well.
Yeah, it's the mix of those two things, isn't it? There's the sort of amazing freedom of the mountains and the being alone and the work and the stuff that you love. And yeah, it's like a lot of traditional societies. It can be very claustrophobic and everybody's stepping on everybody else's toes. And sometimes there isn't room for everybody to be what they want to be and to do the things they want to do. But for all the negative in that and all the pain at times in that, if I'm honest, I there are other things that I think make up for that in a lot of traditional societies. The closeness and the sociability of it and the... I was talking yesterday to the amazing young lady from North Korea who's here at the book festival, and I came out of the session crying, and I ended up being friends with her later in the day, and she was telling me that for all that's wrong with North Korea, and their list of things is horrific, I mean, there's nothing, very little good about North Korea, the one good thing was that the lack of technology and interruption and noise was throwing people back onto themselves, and she was used to sitting in the dark talking to her family for several hours every evening. And I think sometimes that's lost by television and other things, aren't there? So I don't think we should overly romanticise the past. That things change for a reason, but we sometimes lose nice things as well.
What made you want to take an education again, take up learning in a formal sense again?
It was probably the fact I'd fallen out with my dad, and I was a sort of proud but hopelessly broke 20-year-old, thinking, what the hell am I going to do? I wanted to be this person like my grandfather that got respect, and I was reading those books, and I thought, oh, I'll be Ernest Hemingway. Well, that's easy. I'll just have a go at that. I'll write books.
Was your intent to write about the life, though?
Yeah, and the other thing I loved was, and still love, I'm a proper history nerd. I just get through history books like nobody's business. And one of my other heroes is a guy called A.J.P. Taylor, who was the first TV historian in Britain. Amazing writer. He's sort of gone out of fashion as a historian. The historiography's moved on, but he's just an amazing sort of storytelling historian. And I got it in my head, maybe I should do that. The breakthrough moment was my two younger sisters, who didn't have the obligation that I had on me to become the farmer. They're smarter than me. They went for interviews at Oxford and Cambridge, and I was like, what? People in our family can do that? And they were really smart. They were the kids on the front of the newspaper that get like all the A-levels and And I met my wife, and she was like that as well. She'd been really good at school and loads of posh exam results. So I'm looking at them thinking, well, I don't think I'm way more stupid than you. Maybe I could go to night school, get some exams. Maybe I could get into some sort of university. Maybe I can get a job like everyone else in the modern world. Maybe I can earn some money. And maybe in 20 years' time, I'll be able to go back, and when it gets to the crunch point, I'll keep the farm going.
So what was it like then to apply for entry into Oxford University?
It was hilarious because I wasn't really sure I wanted to go. And they invited me for an interview. And this was an interview in the autumn for the following autumn. I hadn't finished my exams. I just had an amazing teacher who, on about 6 weeks of study work, said, we're going to help you to apply to Oxford University. So I ended up in this room with these people, and they must have been looking at my CV, which had absolutely no qualifications on it whatsoever.
Shepherd.
Yeah, I think, what the hell? But it was great, because they wanted to have a debate with me about Margaret Thatcher, and it turned into an absolutely barnstorming row in which I just had the most fun. I completely forgot that they were Oxford professors. I was kicking off. I was telling this guy he was wrong, and this person, what the hell do you know? And we had a huge row about this thing. And then I sort of remembered, just as I'm about to leave, that it was an interview, and I sort of looked across at them, and they're all grinning from ear to ear. And I came out and said to Helen, I got in. And the best bit, I mean, this is horrible. If your children are working hard at school, you really don't want to hear about this. But then the best bit is a week later, I got a letter saying, we know you came to come the following year, but we want you to come in 2 or 3 weeks' time. We don't want you to finish the exams. There's no point in that. So I got into Oxford University with basically no qualifications whatsoever, which makes no sense. But that was kind of scary, because suddenly I pitch up in this place where everybody speaks three languages and they can all play the cello and they've been to Peru. And they've all got gazillions of A's in exams, and I'm thinking, Christ, I don't know anything.
Was that sort of directed at you in a pointed kind of way, or is that past now, that kind of snobbery? Were you made to feel like crap because you weren't that person who could play the cello and speak French?
I think, if I'm honest, part of the appeal was I wanted to go and fight with those people. I really wanted to butt heads with, and I thought everyone's posh and they're all going to look down their nose at me. Probably wasn't like that. I think I couldn't find anyone to fight with. Everyone was sort of really liberal and progressive and nice, and I was like, oh, I wanted to fight with you people. I wanted to beat you. Joking aside, I had the most amazing 3 years there, and I had the most amazing professors, people who were like the leading experts in the world on the First World War or on the Holocaust or whatever it might be, and you get one-on-one tuition with those people, and I learned so much, and I sort of grew up as well. You sort of grow up intellectually, don't you? I'd been a, I think autodidact is the word, isn't it, where you just educate yourself at home. I was one of those, and there was huge gaps in my knowledge, and I didn't really know how to intelligently talk about the things I cared about. And then after 3 years of that sort of really intense Oxford experience, I'd found my feet. I was confident. You don't worry about anything after that.
How homesick were you at Oxford?
Very, very, initially. Because I still had that thing in my heart where I'm like, this isn't the life I'm meant to be doing. I'm not meant to be here.
What do you mean by meant? Who means that for you to do that?
I think more a feeling in me. I've always had such a powerful sense of belonging that it's taken until the last couple of years, actually, for me not to feel sort of violently homesick after about 2 days of wanting to go back. I don't feel that now. I'm really looking. Maybe it's because I've got my kids with me, so I don't feel that. But for most of my life, that was my feeling. And it took me quite a few months of being there to get past that. And I used to do silly things like 7 o'clock in the morning on the farm, we'd always go around and do the shepherding. In Oxford, there wasn't any shepherding, but I woke up at 7 o'clock every morning and had to do something. So I did what I used to call pretend shepherding. I'd walk around housing estates and parks and rivers and go for miles and miles and miles. And it was just sort of my mental way of, like, my head thinks I should be shepherding, so I'll go and do something. And they must have thought I was a complete lunatic.
How about when you go back home, were the people back home impressed with your status as an Oxford scholar?
Some of the girls in our local town were, because they thought I was a complete idiot. And then suddenly, oh, he's the guy that's going to Oxford. So some middle-class 18-year-old girls were more impressed with it than they had been previously with my idiocy. But my friends, it sounds silly, but it was a little bit like Good Will Hunting. Have you seen the movie Good Will Hunting, where it was not a million miles away from that? So like there's still a lot of my best friends. There was a sort of pride there, and they were annoyed at me for being uncomfortable about it. They're like, no, go and do that. Go and stop being scared. Go and have a go at it. So they were sort of proud of it. A little bit like in Good Will Hunting, we'd get into fights with kids that had been to university, and they would like push me to the front to say something clever. It's like, They're going to punch me. I don't want to be at the front.
Go. That's right. Quote Sophocles now. 2001, James, you went home from Oxford for the summer when there'd been an outbreak of foot and mouth disease. Can you describe the terrible spectacle, the spectacle that greeted you when you came back?
Well, when I first came down, sort of everything's in lockdown, so all of the farms are, they're not trading, they're not, you're sort of just living on your farm and you're waiting for something to happen or not happen. Some of our cattle had got foot and mouth disease, which is basically they start slavering in their mouth, and then it was ridiculously bureaucratic. So like the vet that came out who said it's foot and mouth disease had to spend about 3 hours on the phone persuading a bureaucrat in London that it was foot and mouth disease, which is, if it wasn't so tragic, would be one of the funniest phone calls I've ever heard in my life. It was absurd, you know, these two intelligent men talking about whether it's slavering sufficiently and all the rest of it. And then once they'd done that, all the livestock that my grandfather and dad had spent the whole life, well, and me up until then, had spent our whole life breeding, were all shot. Our cattle were wild. They're not handled very often. So the only way that they could kill them was to do it with a police marksman, a sniper. That part of our farm is surrounded by a village where people are living and get on with their lives and the children are playing and all the rest of it. And I've never seen anything like it in my life. There are hundreds of cattle shot around that village and there's roads going past and people are stopping on the roads. And all I can really remember, I somehow ended up in charge of that because my dad didn't want anything to do with it. He sort of went in the house, he just like broken by it, sorry. But yeah, so I don't know, I just went into sort of machine mode. I thought, well, somebody has to sort this out, so.
This is this strain of sheep that's an ancient strain of sheep.
Yeah.
What happened to that breed then? Are they all wiped out, or is there a reserve stock somewhere, or what?
Something sort of very lucky happened, which is foot and mouth disease got within about 2 fields of the Lake District common land, the fells, where all those flocks live, literally within 2 fields. I mean, the disease only has to go about another half a mile or something, and then those pieces of land would have had to been culled as well, and all of the Herdwick sheep in the world, basically, apart from a handful of tiny handful, live in the Lake District fells, and they would have had to clear out the whole, all of that common land, game over, all finished, nothing left. And it didn't get across those 2 fields, and more by luck than good management. And I think it's some of those experiences that made me realise nobody understands, you know, people in London don't know what this is. This isn't on the news because nobody understands what's at risk or what's been there. And I think some of that goes into me wanting to tell everybody. I'm like, actually, this is really beautiful and it's special and it's our thing. It's our history and our part of what makes England, England.
What happens the next day, though, after all the animals have been shot? And you were supposed to, you'd normally get up and go to work. I mean,
oh, it's just weird. And
is there work to do then after they're all?
There was like a cleaning up thing. You have to go in sort of industrial cleanup mode for the farms, which lasts for months and months. But I spoke to an old farmer about a year ago. He was talking to me just after my book came out, and he said he'd cried when he read the foot and mouth part of the book. But he said it brought back to him that he didn't feel like he was him anymore when he didn't have any livestock, and he said, I didn't even feel like I had any friends because his friends are through the sheep. If you're me or him, you are what you do. And then by ceasing to do what you do, you cease to be you. And he said, I just felt like I wasn't anybody.
So your sense of self kind of
just gone.
Blends into the livestock.
Like yeah. That. So he's just suddenly this blank slate that he doesn't know what he is anymore. But hey, let's not all burst into tears. It got restocked. It didn't get on the mountains. For as hellish as that was, that world's quite resilient and it's recovered and most of those stocks have been put back together, and it's a wake up to everybody, A, how dumb and shitty industrial food practices are and how they can screw up everything that we care about, and B, how important some of this stuff is now, fragile, and how some of us have to talk about it and explain it and involve everybody else in it.
Once you finished at Oxford, were you always going to go back to the farm?
Yeah, The funniest bit about Oxford is that you only have to have about 3 or 4 hours of contact time with your professor a week, and they're only 8-week long terms, so I was only there 24 weeks and I actually went home through the week. As long as I had my pile of books, it was fine. I could go back to the farm. Nobody knew, nobody cared. I didn't want to socialise with anyone there. I was just there to do a thing.
So you never really left the farm to go
really,
to Oxford?
Not really. No.
And what did you graduate with?
I got, who cares in one way, but I got a double first and...
Hang on, just a minute. A double first in what? Shepherding or what?
I got a double first in modern history, and then they offered me a scholarship to do another year to do a master's, and I got a distinction in that if we're showing off, Mum.
Shh. sheep taught him everything he knew. What did your tutors there or your professors think you were going to do then after you'd graduated? Did they know you were going to go back to the, stay on the farm?
They actually all became my friends, and some of them are still my friends. And they, I think they got me. I think they knew I was quite uncomfortable there. I think some of them thought I should stay and I should do a PhD and I should become an academic, and I could have done that, and a tiny little bit of me would have enjoyed that. But anyway, that's another life that didn't happen. So I went back, and I think they were, I don't know whether they were shocked or disappointed or what they were, but hey, you've got to do what you've got to do, haven't you?
How many sheep do you have on the farm now?
We have about 1,000 at the moment, which is quite small by Australian standards, but where we are is about normal.
Does the land there toughen up the sheep and make them more robust, the very nature of that environment?
Yeah, that's really simple. The winter like we've just had will kill any sheep that isn't tough enough. And if you put that over 5,000 years worth of really severe winters, then you end up with very, very tough sheep that survive. One of the earliest mentions of what we do is in the Icelandic sagas, which I know you like, and they talk about putting the sheep up in the summer in the mountains, and I think even at times putting them up in the winter. And the deal was, if some of them come down, they're the toughest ones, and that's fine, but lots of them won't. We're not as ruthless as that. We try and keep them all alive, but it's a very, very old system.
There's an episode of Father Ted on Craggy Island. One of the farmers comes to Father Ted with a picture of his favourite sheep, and they say, look at him, he looks terrible, he looks depressed. And it's like everyone can recognise individual sheep, but is that true? Can you actually recognise your... Could you look at it in a bunch of... Oh, that's mine. That's actually my sheep. Can you do that?
Yeah, no, not only can I do that, but absolutely every shepherd that's worth their money in our system does. You know, every sheep, you know what their father was, what their mother was, what their offspring have ever been.
Therefore, I suppose anyone can steal anyone else's sheep, can they?
No. Because all those sheep are on the mountain together, you end up with a really, really complicated culture of sheep identification and other systems and rules, basically. So on the mountain where I live, all of our sheep have to have a particular mark on them. It's almost unheard of for anybody to break the rules, because if you're going to live next door to somebody for about 50 generations, boy, do you not do anything that they might think was illegal. So, in fact, on our mountain, when we're sorting the sheep, if there's a sheep without any identification on it, all of the shepherds are bending over backwards not to take that sheep, because your reputation is worth more than the sheep is. It's sort of, no, you have it. No, I don't want it. You have it. But please don't think I was the guy that took it when it maybe wasn't mine. And there is one family in a very long history that I know of who recently were prosecuted because they started to cheat. They started changing the marks on the sheep, and they started stealing people's sheep off the mountain. And
they now live in North Korea.
They aren't going to live where we live for very long, much longer, I can tell you that. Because there's a sort of code of honour with this. And those people now are effectively blackballed out of it. They rely upon selling sheep to other people, and when they take the sheep into the auction mart, all of the other farmers walk out of the ring or turn their back on them. That sounds tough, but that's the rules, that's the way it is, and they're finished. They're going to sell their farm and they're going to go do something else, and if I'm honest, nobody will shed any tears for them. They've done something incredibly stupid.
What's it like shepherding when the snow is actually really thick on the ground in winter?
The sheep can cope with it better than the people can, is the truth of it. Those sheep are really, really, really tough. It isn't so much the snow that's dangerous, it's the drifting of the snow. So on the mountains where we live, people get killed occasionally. So when we go to gather the mountain in November, there's no snow that's the problem, but you've got to be really careful. Sometimes you're like 10 yards away from the edge of a cliff. If the clouds start to come down, we basically all have to leave the mountain. You don't want to be wandering around next to a cliff in a cloud. And it reminds you that you're not in charge. Nature's in charge.
You mentioned earlier about Wordsworth coming to the Lake District and immortalising it in verse and saying more or less, along with other poets, that it really should be seen as part of Britain's great natural heritage. Yep. It's one of the great glories of England as a whole. Yep. But how does that work for someone like you who has to live and work in the area, when you've got tourists coming into the area all the time and they feel like, I suppose they have a sense of ownership of it as well. How does that work with you when you've got all these tourists tripping over you when you're trying
The first thing to say is the numbers are amazing. So 43,000 people live in that landscape, but they live in three towns, sort of small clusters, and there are 16 million people a year come and visit. So the numbers are remarkable, and we know that Wordsworth, who in many ways sort of invented the love of it, he was starting to get really pissed off when there were 15,000 visitors a year coming. So God only knows what he'd have made of it, but the truth is, what we do has survived because of the interaction with the tourists and the money that they spend. They spend over £2 billion a year, and as you just said, I didn't realise it when I was 20 years old, I just wish they'd bugger off, really, but now that I've grown up, I get what they need. I have worked for short periods of times in cities. I get that we all need places to breathe and escape and walk, and that right's every bit as important as my right to want to keep what my family's history going. So I in no way want to stop it. I just want to make it... I want the two things to understand each other better. One of the reasons I wrote the book was, if all those people are going to walk past my farm, I'd really like it if they knew what we were doing or cared or saw what it was.
You mentioned that your father was able to read your book before he died. And you also, I get the sense you want to kind of honour that life in a book. Is this book really a letter to your dad?
It took me a while after he died to realise it, but I think that's exactly what it is. I wrote a letter to my dad, and he's way too northern and macho to tell me he liked it, but my mum said he cried a lot when he read it, so he was obviously touched by it. And my sister said, "Dad, do you actually like the book?" when I wasn't there. And his exact words were, "I'm a bit surprised that I come out of it as a fucking legend." The only thing he said to me was, because the last line of the afterward, I said, "Look, I hope this makes clear how much I love and respect you." And he said, "Bit soppy."
And on the very unsoppy note, ladies and gentlemen, please thank James Rebanks.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
I spoke to James Rebanks at the 2016 Sydney Writers' Festival. James's books are The Shepherd's Life and The Illustrated Herdwick Shepherd. 4 years on, James is still shepherding and tweeting. He has another son and a new book coming later this year called English Pastoral. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Hey, you're clearly someone who loves quality conversations and big ideas, right? I like your style. I'm Jan Fran, and I'm here to recommend another podcast I think you'll love. Mine. The Pineapple Project is a life improvement podcast, and we have a new season all about connection.
One of the most important things you can do now is to invest in your relationships.
They made a gesture to me that was just so helpful and blew me away.
Other people are scary. Why would you make friends with other people on your street?
You are not a solo performer. You're a member of a choir.
Throughout the series, I uncover a key finding from the world's largest and longest study on happiness, discover a crucial relationship that a lot of us neglect, and find the one terrible mistake that we are all making with our phones, and how to fix it. It's pretty life-changing, and it'll improve your own conversations in your own life. I promise. Come on over to the Pineapple Project in the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.